The field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Welcome back, everyone, and welcome to everyone just joining us on Sirius Channel 93 here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Getting ready for this Wednesday Trainer Talk edition of the Final Furlong Show. Live from our Lexington, Kentucky studios, Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, he's the Pontiff of the Pick Four. Ready to roll for the next hour with a couple of special guests. Going to be a really fun show as we visit with Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott coming up in just about 5 minutes from right now. And then Tom Proctor will be here at 6:30 Eastern Time. And, of course, you can also tune in Sirius 93 XM 209. And, Jude, we couldn't have more two people with more different personalities here today.
Yeah. Bill Mott, you know, rather quiet, reserved, contemplative kind of trainer, and Tom Proctor, kind of wild.
To say the
and
least.
And out there. Great guys, both of them, and both of them talented at their craft, and it's going to be a great show. It's kind of the yin and yang show.
Bill Mott, the native of Mobridge, South Dakota. Can't wait to ask him about growing up in Mobridge and how does somebody from Mobridge, South Dakota get hooked on the sport of horse racing and become an elite trainer, much the way Bill Mott has done. And Tom Proctor, a native of Gilmer, Texas, now residing in Louisville and in Oldsmar, Florida. He's out in California right now, so he's going to join us by phone from California. But looking forward to visiting with him and hearing his story, because they have to be completely different types of stories. You know, when you look at growing up in a place like Mobridge, South Dakota, and then, of course, Gilmer, Texas, where there is some horse racing around. So it's going to be interesting to hear those two.
Yeah. It is a contrast, and I'm really interested to, I know Tom's story because we've been friends a while, but I don't know Bill's, and I'm looking forward to that. He's a guy that I've really gotten to be fond of, made a lot of money with his horses in the last several years, and, you know, training in California and being a West Coast guy for so long, I didn't really get a chance to see his horses run that often.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw Cigar, but that wasn't a great day for him. But, you know, since I moved here and been able to interview him after races at Keeneland and watch his, you know, work live and in color, it's really enlightened me to the fact that the guy's super, super sharp.
Bill Mott, the ninth trainer in North American thoroughbred history to reach 4,000 victories. He did that back in 2010. We're going to talk to him about that. We'll talk to him about learning from some of the greats, including Jack Van Berg, who he worked with for a few years and went out on his own in 1978. It was a great decision because, as I mentioned, and everybody knows, Bill Mott now in the Hall of Fame, and he's won countless graded stakes races, and again, more than 4,000 races for his career. Probably best known for that run that he had with Cigar for Alan Paulson back in 1995 and 96, winning a record tying 16 consecutive races.
Yeah, he he was on quite the streak and did it at a top level. You often hear people say, "Oh, this horse didn't, you know, run against the best," or that. Nobody said that about Cigar. He was running against the nuts all the time. He was the nuts.
And how about this? Bill Mott has won 9 training titles at Saratoga, 10 titles at Belmont Park, 9 at Gulfstream, 5 at Keeneland, and he's the all-time winningest trainer at Churchill Downs. Set the record for the number of victories at a single Churchill Downs meet with 54 during the 1984 spring meet. So it doesn't matter where Bill Mott has raced his horses, he's been successful, and successful in a big way.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to find out too how he decides where to go. You know, he's won training titles at so many different tracks, and has he done it simultaneously? Or I mean, you know,
right? Yeah,
you got horses at in Florida. You got horses here.
Well, that's
you
the thing, and not just with Bill Mott, but with so many of these trainers now that have these big strings. He has 100 horses, approximately 100 horses in training right now. And as a former trainer, Jude, I know you never had that many, but how do you keep up with so many horses at so many different locations? I guess you have to have good assistants.
Yeah, well, that is for sure. But, you know, he has 100. Pletcher's got like 300, right?
Yeah.
Lord knows how many Chad Brown has.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's a whole different kettle of fish, you know. But 100 horses is plenty. When I started training, the maximum you could have was 40 on the grounds at Santa Anita.
Really?
Yeah. You could only have 40 stalls.
And they wouldn't, that was it. That was the most they would give you.
Yeah. And the super trainers like Charlie Whittingham and Bobby Frankel, those guys, they would have horses at San Luis Rey Downs or somewhere else, you know, but most people stuck to the 40 on the track. So it's a whole different situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, Bill Mott is going to be here with us in just a moment. And again, a man who began his training career on his own in 1978 after working for Hall of Fame trainer Jack Van Berg. It turned out to be an outstanding decision as he is now in the Hall of Fame. He's amassed more than 4,200 victories for his career, as I mentioned, just the ninth trainer in North American Thoroughbred history to reach that 4,000 win plateau, that coming back in 2010. He is a member of Racing's Hall of Fame and winning training titles at so many different racetracks around the country. And how about this? More than $210 million in career purse earnings amassed by Bill Mott trainees. And Bill, nice enough to take some time to join us here on Trainer Talk this evening. Bill, thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Happy to have you on board. And Bill, when you hear those kinds of numbers and statistics about your career, what goes through your mind?
I guess it took more than a week or two to amass those numbers. So it's been a long time coming. You know, it didn't happen overnight. I guess the career has spanned quite a few years, and there's been some good years and some bad years, but we've been very fortunate to have some very, very good horses to carry us along and kind of, you know, horses at all levels to amass, you know, that number of winners. But as far as the money figure, you know, you can tell that there's been some good horses that have won the right races, you know, in that group.
Well, we'll talk about some of those horses that have been very special to you throughout your career, but let's start from the beginning. How does a kid growing up in Mobridge, South Dakota, end up becoming hooked on horse racing and becoming a Hall of Fame trainer?
Well, it's pretty easy for me. You know, my father was a veterinarian, so we were exposed to animals and horses, of course, and cattle and large and small animals, and so I guess from a very early age, I was you know, would help him with his veterinary practice, whether it be, you know, with the it was mostly a cattle practice, but we did, you know, did horses and he worked on horses and I mean, we're talking about farm and ranch horses, and we were out west, so initially it wasn't race horses, but my father was always interested in race horses, and he got involved with the Asmussen family. I guess that probably would have been about 13 or 14 years old at the time, and he and my father and Keith Asmussen bought a couple of race horses together and a few brood mares, and then that's how the job started for me. I went from working on the ranch and helping my dad in the off season from school to going to the racetrack when I was 14 years old, working for the Asmussen family.
How big is Mobridge?
Well, when I was growing up, it was 5,000 people, and I think it's down to about less than 4,000 now. So it tells you a lot of people are moving away from that part of the country. I guess a lot of the young people move away now just because there's, you know, not as much opportunity there. I guess they move to, you know, more populated areas of the country, and it's farming and ranch country, and of course some of the mom and pop operations are going a little bit by the wayside out there, and there's more corporate farming, big outfits coming in, taking over the land, you know, and doing the farming on a much larger scale than what they had in the past. Although it's, you know, still productive area. I mean, the landscape is changing just a little bit.
When you left the farm and went to the track, where did you start out?
We went to, well, actually, the first year, I mean, of course, I worked at Asmussen's ranch for a few weeks before we went to the racetrack. They had a place in Agar, South Dakota, and which was about 60 miles away from where I lived. And then, you know, during the summer, we stabled our horses at Attakad Park, which was in South Sioux City, Nebraska. And we raced across the river, and it's kind of a tri-state area that we raced at Park Jefferson. And I guess that would have been back in 66, maybe, 67, something like that, 66, 67. And actually, Wayne Lucas was racing there at the time, and he was racing quarter horses, and that's the first time I'd run across him. I guess I was 15 by the time I met him. But so that, you know, Park Jefferson and Aberdeen and Fort Pierce, South Dakota, that was it for me in the beginning.
Lucas was doing the same thing you were. He was taking time off of school to be in the horse business during the summers.
Right. Well, he did. He got a pretty good start on it. I mean, he always ran even back then when we were racing at Park Jefferson, I mean, he always had an upscale outfit, and I used to sneak over to his barn and look at his operation and see what was going on. And he was a very hard worker. I mean, he'd be there all day working with his horses and did his own feeding and did everything himself. I mean, he definitely was very, very hands-on and did very well with quarter horses before he moved over to the thoroughbreds.
Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bill, you mentioned Jefferson Park. Park Jefferson. And that's the place where you won your very first race, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I can't even remember when I was, I guess my first race I won when I was probably 15, and I think my father was listed as trainer because I wasn't old enough to get a license. And I think maybe the next year when I was 16, I was either 16 or 17 when I got my first trainer's license. So, I guess Park Jefferson was probably where the first recognized track that I ran at that I had a winner.
Who was the horse? Do you remember?
Well, the first horse I won with actually, and I think this one was listed as, my father was listed as trainer, was a mare called My Assets. She had been purchased out of the sale out in California, I think, which at the time was at Pomona, which I think now is where they have the Barrett sale. And we didn't cost much. And then Keith Asmussen trained her the first year, and then they had a dispersal sale, and we bought her. So my dad bought her for $300, and she had a bowed tendon, and that's, you know, I got her back up to the races, and we ran her at an unrecognized track in Fort Pierce, South Dakota, and she dead-heated for the win in her first race. It was a $500 purse, and they had a blanket, a cooler that, you know, the winner got. So because it was a dead heat, we flipped the coin for the blanket, and I won the coin toss, and I still have the blanket to this day.
That's cool.
Wow.
So it's clear to me now how you amassed over 4,000 wins, because, you know, usually guys that have won 4,000 races are old and crotchety, and you're certainly far from that. You're a very handsome guy. You put on a fantastic appearance in the paddock always. And I was just, when we were prepping for the show, Mike said, you know, it's 4,000 races. I go, he couldn't have won 4,000 races. He's not that old. But that explains that you started, you were like, started at 16.
Early.
Yeah.
Started
before
early.
You could drive.
Yeah.
Bill, I mentioned you worked with Hall of Fame trainer Jack Van Berg. Tell us about that and how that all came about.
Well, I'd already been training a few years on my own, just our family's horses. My dad had a couple horses, and I actually bought one or two of my own while I was in school. And so I would train them during the summers. You know, I moved on to my junior and senior year of high school, and I trained them over the summer. And I guess, of course, I didn't go to college, so I moved on to wound up. The first year I kind of moved out of South Dakota, I went to Denver and then through Nebraska. You know, I raced at Centennial Park and then went back into Nebraska. I guess when I was I couldn't get stalls at the main Centennial Park meet. My horses weren't good enough. So I wound up going to Lincoln, Nebraska, and raced at Lincoln and Columbus and Attica. And then that was kind of my first full year of training. And the next year I made my way out to Detroit. And the one horse I lost in a claiming race right off the bat and didn't have much left. So I went to work for a fellow named Bob Irwin, who was had been an assistant for Mr. Van Berg, Marion Van Berg, for years. And I worked for Bob for 3 years. Galloped horses and always had a horse of two of my own, and then after 3 years with him, then I went to work for Van Berg, and I worked for Jack for 3 years. So, you know, I learned an awful lot from everybody I've worked for, but particularly Bob Irwin. I think, he taught me an awful lot. I asked a lot of questions, and I think it was good preparation for me. When I went to work for Van Berg, I started out galloping horses for him, and he realized I probably was maybe, you know, a little more knowledgeable about horses and had maybe some, you know, had some miles under my belt already. And he offered me a job as an assistant. He said, let me give you the same deal that I give Frankie Brothers. So Frankie and I were both working at the same time as assistants for Jack. And I did that for 3 years. And then Jack made the move out to California, kind of permanently, and I stayed in the Midwest and raced around Detroit and was actually able to keep some of the clients that we had previously. So I then started up a public stable. So that would have been in the fall of like 1986, I believe. And that would have been, I lose track of time. That was 79. Certain years are big years in my career, and I guess that would have been one of the big ones. It was the fall of 78, and I guess my first year of training a public stable would have been 1979, you know, where I trained for other people outside horses besides just my own.
Talk about some of the great clients you've had over the years. You've trained for a lot of different people, and, you know, now you've got Judmon, obviously, one of the great jobs. But talk about some of your clients Maybe an interesting story or two about somebody.
Well, you know, I started out with the guys in Detroit that were, you know, the locals around Detroit, and we bought and owned some horses together, but moving, you know, then moving on to Kentucky, you know, one of my first clients was trained for a fellow named W.F. Lucas, who was a Louisville resident, and he only would have two or three horses at a time, but they were always nice horses. He was one of the vice presidents of Brown Foreman Distilleries in Kentucky, and, you know, a great guy. Trained for a fellow named, I had a horse for him. I had rapid gray shot and miss, Taylor Special, El Puma, you know, all those horses were, you know, Saturday sort of horses. And then a fellow named Mr. Rudder at the same time. These were all back in 1979. Mr. Rudder was chairman of the board of the Fairgrounds racetrack at the time, and I trained several horses for him, and those fellows were all very good to me and gave me a real, you know, real opportunity with nice horses to start out with, and it just one thing led to another, and I wound up with horses for a fellow named Fareed Sifa, who was from Detroit, from Brighton, Michigan, and he was actually pretty big in the business at one time with, you know, a fairly large stable and mostly claiming horses, but, you know, it gave us the opportunity to be in action and win a lot of races. You know, moving on to Kentucky, I trained for so many, you know, I trained for people that I still train for today, people that I trained for in like the early 80s, Dr. David Richardson and Hiram Polk. They're both doctors from Louisville, and they've remained some of my most loyal clients over the years. I mean, and not only good clients, but good friends besides. And you know, Warner Jones had horses with me when he was alive, Hermitage Farm, and I've trained for Governor Jones actually back then. You know, just so many people from Kentucky, but I did very well around Kentucky through the early 80s. And, you know, we won several trainer titles, I guess 8 or 9 trainer titles at Churchill and several at Keeneland. And, you know, I guess to this day, we still have the record number of wins and stake wins at Churchill Downs. I don't think anybody's going by us yet, but, you know, a few of them breathing down our necks. But, you know, then in the fall of 1986, I had the opportunity to get a private job with the Firestones, with Bert and Diana Firestone. And that, at that time, you know, I looked down, I'd had really good horses in the barn, you know, in the mid-80s. I had, at one time, I had 3 millionaires in the barn, which I remember back in the mid-80s, there was, you know, they used to publish a list of millionaires in the Blood Horse magazine, just like they would have a list of the top stallions. But they had, like, the list of millionaires, which was probably a list that was less than 25 horses at the time. And I had, at one point, I had 3 of the horses on the millionaire list. I had Heatherton, Sifa's Beauty, and Taylor Special, and they were all 3 of them were on the millionaires list at that time, which was, you know, I thought a pretty big accomplishment, and I think it, you know, an indication of what, you know, the quality of horses that I was able to get at that time. But then all those horses were starting to, they were being retired toward, you know, the later 80s, and the opportunity came up with the Firestones and the opportunity to go to New York. So I was reluctant to take the job at the time, but it turned out to be a very good deal. I took the job, went to New York, and in 1987, I had my first Breeders' Cup winner and my first champion, which was Theatrical, which Theatrical was probably and has been and probably always will be maybe the horse that's had the most influence on my career and my lifestyle and my life and my, you know, whether it be, you know, every aspect. I mean, just it really kind of gave me a, you know, a bump and a head start into sort of the national, you know, arena with, you know, winning the Breeders' Cup. He won 6 grade ones that first year and was voted champion. So he's my first Breeders' Cup winner, my first champion. You know, and then over the years I was able to have a lot of his offspring that did a lot of good. You know, I've trained, you know, for part of their career, I trained Shakespeare and Royal Anthem and some very good horses. I trained some of the better ones that he ever produced. So a very good horse, and I owe Theatrical and the Firestones an awful lot for that opportunity.
Yeah, I read.
And actually, the Paulsons owned a part of Theatrical. They weren't Mr. Paulson. Alan Paulson was a partner in him, and that's how I made the connection with Mr. Paulson for later on.
Yeah, and that didn't work out very good for you, did it?
Well, I think I had four or five Breeders' Cup winners for them. You know, we had Fraze and Agena, Asena, and Cigar, and they were all Breeders' Cup winners and all champions. Yeah. Well, I guess maybe Fraze wasn't a champion, but he was a Breeders' Cup winner, and I had several champions for him. So, you know, that was a long and rewarding relationship with them, and I got to tell you, you know, between the Firestones and Mr. and Mrs. Paulson, Alan Paulson, what a great guy he was. I mean, just he was a man's man, and he was a real, both families, the Firestones and the Paulsons, were very sporting, loved horses, and loved to challenge and loved to win. And they liked all the things that I wanted and craved, and they always excelled at the top of the game and gave everybody around them a chance to do the same.
Well, Bill, you told me last night when I called you and asked you to come on the show that 25 minutes was going to be an awful long time for you to do an interview with us, and I have to tell you, we're just about done. Yeah. We could have spent 2.5 hours with you here.
I didn't allow for many questions, that I get to rambling, but
no, it's great.
I guess you ask about, one thing kind of leads to another, and you ask about all the people and the good horses, and there's just so many of them, and there's so many that, you to mention, and so many good ones that, I owe such a big part of my life to, and all those good things led my family and my children and the homes that I've been able to, afford to live in. It's all come from the horses. So, any risk that I ever take with the horses is no risk at all, really, because they've put everything in place for me up to this point.
Well, Bill, just about 2 minutes or so left here before we have to move on. Tom Proctor set to join us in the second half of Trainer Talk from California, but we haven't even really talked about Cigar. You mentioned him one time. Give us your favorite Cigar story during that remarkable run back in the mid-90s.
Well, I don't know. I'd almost have to, to tell you what's my favorite thing and go through I'd almost have to go through his entire career with me to give you the favorite story. But there were a lot of interesting things that happened, I guess, during that point in time. And it was like after he got on the win streak and we started going from place to place. Of course, we had already been to Dubai and won 10 in a row in 1995 and a championship and a Breeders' Cup, which was a very emotional time for me. I mean, I just to have a horse like that was just, it'll almost bring me to tears every time just thinking about it. But we, then going to Dubai and the challenge of going to Dubai and being the first one over there, we didn't know where we were going. Nobody knew where we were going. It was new for me as a person. We didn't know what kind of racetrack we were going to get, involved with, and to have him come out the winner, I mean, it was just kind of a surreal sort of experience. But everywhere we went after that, I mean, some of the most fun places we took him. We took him around the country. We took him to Boston, to Suffolk Downs, to run in the Mass Cap there 2 years in a row. We did that both years after we came back from Dubai. So he won his first race, He won 2 years in a row. I guess after coming back from Dubai, he won there again, and that for the second time. But then, of course, we wound up, you know, Chicago, the Citation Challenge, and then we went out to California, to Del Mar for the Pacific Classic. And I mean, the people were lined up. We got, you know, we got police escorts from the racetrack. And I remember we unloaded and we were in the barn. We were in Shoemaker's barn out in California when we took him out there, and people walking around. We had guards at both ends of the barn just, you know, to keep people from going through. But some girl had come through with a clipboard, looked very important. You know, everybody probably thought, well, maybe she's with the racetrack. Who knows? She's with media, publicity. I guess you can, if you take a clipboard and a pen and walk through someplace, you can almost get anywhere. This girl was walking through, the cigar had been put in his stall, and this girl was walking through the Shedro, and, you know, nobody paid too much attention to her. And all of a sudden she got the cigar stall, and she ducked under the webbing, grabbed a handful of feces and put them in a jar and ran out of the stall, ran out of the other end of the barn. And it was like, did anybody else see that? Do we really believe what we just saw? And so it was, you know, there were some pretty strange things that happened, but I didn't know that, you know, people were quite into those type of souvenirs. But I guess, you know, rather than a lock of his hair or, you know, a horseshoe that came off of him during one of his big races.
Yeah, how about a bridle?
Enough. They got, how they about got a bridle? Something hot. They got something that was, you know, hot and warm, with a nice aroma.
Well, Bill, we have to get to the second half of the show, but you have to promise to come back on with us again here in the future, because we are just scratching the surface. We'd love to hear more, and always a pleasure to visit with you. We want to thank you for taking the time to be with us for a little bit here this evening.
Okay, very good.
All right, thanks so much. The man who couldn't get stalls at Centennial Park, Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott, our special guest here. And looking forward to the second half of the show coming up in just a moment. Tom Proctor, he's up next, live from California, here on Trainer Talk on the Final Furlong on HRRN Live.
Imagine having 80 channels of live, full card, uninterrupted simulcast feeds delivered direct to your home television for just $50 a month. Choose from your favorite thoroughbred, harness, quarter horse, and greyhound tracks in North America and internationally. Call Dish Network at 1-888-677-5487 and ask for RTN, the Racetrack Television Network. RTN is the only place where you can see every race from every simulcast every day.
RaceHorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RaceHorseReport.com. Make RaceHorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RaceHorseReport.com.
Introducing the Wizards Betting Window, a new wagering product available exclusively at DRF.com. The Wizards Betting Window takes the work out of wagering by giving you easy-to-use wagering recommendations for every race in the card at top tracks around the country. Both longtime horse players and racing newcomers can benefit from using the Betting Window, which suggests not only win-and-place bets, but also exotics including exactas, trifectas, daily doubles, and dime superfectas. And what really sets this product apart is the Betting Window Final Edition. Just download the Betting Window while you do your handicapping in advance, and then receive an update 30 to 60 minutes before the first race post time. You'll get all the latest scratches, current track and weather conditions, and late equipment changes. The Betting Window Final Edition will be delivered right to your inbox, so you can receive it anywhere. So use the Wizards' best wagering strategies to help maximize your returns. Visit drf.com/wizbw to try it today. That's drf.com/wizbw for the Wizards Betting Window.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday on the Final Furlong on HRRN Live.
Welcome back to HRRN Live's Trainer Talk edition of the Final Furlong Show here on this Wednesday afternoon. Mike Penna, Jude Feld in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. A really, really interesting visit with Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott in the first half of the show, and really looking forward to our next special guest, Tom Proctor, the native of Gilmer, Texas, joining us live from California here on Trainer Talk this afternoon. Tom, thanks for taking the time.
No problem. Just sitting here at Hollywood Park at the barn.
All right. How's everything at Hollywood? Stop raining?
Well, you know, it's absolutely hilarious that, you know, I just come from Tampa, and if they'd had as much rain as they had at Hollywood Park in 10 minutes, you wouldn't know it's rain. It's a kind of a mud hole here right now, all this adobe they got in California. I mean, it doesn't hold the water. The track's fine. It's just getting to and from the track. It's pretty nasty.
Well, Tom, this show very much about your life and your background and how you got started. And much like so many other trainers in the business, it was kind of in your pedigree from the beginning. Talk about that.
Well, most trainer sons aren't worth 2 cents.
You're the exception to that rule.
And I might fit into that category. background, you know, I grew up in Texas. Dad had a training center there, farm. We had cattle on another farm and horses on a main farm there. And my Uncle Jack ran that. He was a top calf roper in his day when he was young. Probably the best horseman in the whole family, my Uncle Jack. He pretty much raised me during the school year. I mean, he'd whip me just like a father if I did wrong. And worked for him, and he always made sure I had money and a car to chase the girls. So that's where I got that from. And it taught me a lot about horses. And also had another uncle that I worked with that ran Glen Hill Farm. He worked on the gate, trained horses. His name was Alan. And he managed Glen Hill Farm before my brother took over.
But your dad, Willard, for those people that don't know, one of the all-time great trainers, should be in the Hall of Fame. We're working on that, and he obviously had a big influence on your career. Talk about him a little bit.
Well, I mean, you know, Dad meant everything to me, and you know, he was just as much a stand-up guy as anybody could be. I mean, and never did anything he thought was wrong, and ran his business that way, ran his horses that way, and, you know, he always... probably the most stand-up guy you could ever be around. And definitely, I tell you, Dad was one of those guys that just had the best instincts about a racehorse. He really did. I mean, I was lucky to be around two guys. I always thought my Uncle Jack had the best instincts about a horse and riding and everything. But Dad had as good instincts as you could want with a racehorse.
Tom, talk about what it was like for you being around so many great horses that your dad trained. You're growing up, you're watching these horses run, you're learning from him. What was that like for you?
Well, we probably pretty much thought that was normal. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, he had Woozum, Gallant Romeo, Mary the Prince in the Midwest, Foggy Note, which is probably in almost every horse's pedigree now. Even if it goes back five generations, if you look at studs and mares and stuff, you know, and then he came out west and had a lot of good horses. I mean, I was there the day that Convenience won the match race, and there the vanity the race before. And actually, between my junior and senior year, I rubbed Convenience when she won the vanity and beat Susan's Girl. And, you know, you just were around a lot of nice horses, a lot of good clients, and, you know, just a lot of good memories. And it wasn't easy. I mean, Dad was a very hard guy to work for, and I probably took the blunt of it. I mean, you know, hey, thank God I did, because I think it helped me a lot. But, I mean, he was definitely harder on me than anybody else. And probably had to be. I mean, look, I was a little bit of a rogue when I was young.
No.
You still wear a lip chain once in a while, don't you?
Yeah. It's not as difficult to keep me in check now. So.
Well, I remember working around the track and people that worked for your dad. You know, they took great pride in working for your dad, and everybody knew that he was tough. If you met somebody and you said, "Oh, who are you working for?" and they said Willard Proctor, you automatically had respect for that person because you knew their job wasn't easy. Your dad required a lot, but the horses, you know, ran to his care.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he took as good a care of the horse he could. He didn't believe in hardly any needle work. I mean, when we're talking about, he probably, and I've become a little more that way, as less you can stick them with the needle, they probably like it more. I don't go to the doctor. I don't like shots, so I don't think my horses do either. I mean, if it wasn't for the state vets that are a little bit incompetent nowadays, I probably wouldn't even give a butte shot. I mean, they don't understand that Magic Johnson, when he ran out on the court, he was stiff, or Kobe Bryant, he's stiff. Sometimes these horses are stiff, but they, you know, loosen up, warm out of it. And other than that, I probably wouldn't ever give a butte shot. You know, less is better, I found out lately, if just take care of the horse.
Trainer Tom Proctor, our special guest here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Tom, you have Willard, your son, who obviously you named in honor of your dad. Is he in the horses as well? Is he into them?
Not in the least. I mean, he likes going to the races and being with me, but I mean, it's something he just never really wanted to do.
You've become kind of a sire of golfers.
Well, both of them, my daughter could really play. I mean, she's kind of, got it on the back burner now. She had a little trouble in school. Her breeding come out in her. And she was definitely a Division I player, and probably top-notch Division I player. But she's more of an individual-type player. I don't think the team concept was too high on her list. Didn't like the cattiness of it so much. You know, she needs to mature a little bit. That'll come. And you know, whatever she wants to do, playing a little golf isn't going to hurt her. I mean, that's 5 hours of not getting in trouble.
There you go.
Tom, when you look back on your career and you look at all the outstanding horses that you've had the privilege to be around, you're closing in on 1,000 career victories. Talk about some of those horses that really stand out to you, and why do they stand out?
Well, you know, first horse I trained was a horse called I'm Smoking. He always will have a special place with me in my heart. And, I mean, not only he was a really neat horse, he was fast. Probably still the fastest horse I ever trained, far as just being fast. Just been very lucky to have a lot of nice horses. You know, One Dreamer meant a lot. She was just a locomotive type filly, ran as hard and as far as she could, and had a really good pace to her. One horse I had called House of County, he won a lot of races, went some stakes, actually broke his maiden February 14th of his two-year-old year, and he ran till he was 13. So, you know, but he's the argument against two-year-old racing hurts him. And you know, was lucky with a horse called Split Run that wasn't the soundest horse. Been very lucky lately, you know, with Cortana and Snowtop Mountain. And, you know, Marketing Mix I've had this year has been really nice. Just, you can go down the list. I just like even some of the cheaper horses that win and have a good personality. And, give you what they got, you're very lucky to be around good horses, and you're doubly lucky if you're around good horses and around good people that help you manage, let you manage them right.
I've seen a lot of Breeders' Cups, but one of the ones that I will never forget is when you won with One Dreamer. I just think that was, it was so cool to see you, you know, pull that off, be in the winner's circle, and of course Glen Hill Farm. You know, your family's got a great relationship with them. Talk about that Glen Hill Farm relationship and the long standingness of it.
Well, you know, Dad and Mr. Lavin are the start of it. And, you know, we're talking about two honest men that had the passion of racing horses and breeding horses. And, you know, they did things right from buying a nice farm in Florida and buying some nice brood stock and took care of their horses. Never really stepped out and went too crazy in this business. You know, kept a foot on first base, but didn't mind, you know, leading off a little bit. And it's been a pretty good MO of how to run a horse racing business. And main thing is the honesty of the people involved, and, you know, working for a common goal, and even see that with Craig. I mean, God, I laugh, and Craig was at the barn with me yesterday at Tampa, and I kind of chuckled that I enjoyed having him there and going over the horses. You know, hey, we're working for the same thing, whether they got a problem or not. There's no reason to hide a problem. It's out there. Show it to them and explain what's going on, what your thoughts are, and take it from there. I own horses, and all mine got problems. That's what I tell them. Just because I train them doesn't mean they ain't got problems. And, you know, it just was kind of neat. But, you know, at the end of the year, we kind of reflected on this year and last year. You know, Craig kind of took over a few years ago, and probably one of his deals, me and Craig's always been close, and he kind of wanted me to help him with the racing part, you know, put it in one single trainer. And luckily, we've been a little successful. And I just told him, I said, some of these fillies we won with lately at Hollywood, it's just nice to get some wins in them, get some racing at a higher level. And it's just nice to see. And I kind of enjoyed, you know, me and Craig talking about it in the morning.
Tom, going back to One Dreamer for a minute. A lot of people probably don't know the full story behind One Dreamer and how special that really was. Tell us about that Breeders' Cup and coming up to that race, and then just those moments afterwards when she gets it done.
Well, you know, it really meant a lot. In a way, I wish my dad would have trained her, because I think he'd have been in the Hall of Fame if he would have. So it's a little bit bittersweet there, you know. But there was a mare that was really a good mare in the Midwest. And in those years, the Breeders' Cup were mostly won by horses on the East Coast and West Coast. And this mare had dominated around the Midwest. And that might have helped her that, you know, they maybe didn't think as much. I mean, in the spring that year, she beat it. She won the Louisville Distaff or Churchill Downs Distaff. I mean, heck, she won by five. Of course, it was muddy, and I'd run her mostly on the turf, but she was a kind of a freak at Churchill. I've never seen a, you know, I always thought that Churchill's surface, a lot of horses didn't like it. Some horses put up with it, and about 5% really liked it, and she was one of those 5% that really liked it. And the whole year was thinking, well, let's get her back, you know, keep her kind of have a conservative game plan, keep her in the Midwest, don't go nowhere, and just keep her here where we can get her back to the Breeders' Cup and hopefully run into money. Well, you know, did a little better than that. You know, and I think a couple of the top, there was a lot of champions in there. Hollywood Wildcat, Sky Beauty, Heavenly Prize, and, you know, those mares were top-notch mares. Were they coming into the race at tip-top? Well, maybe a couple of them weren't. But, you know, that's how the Breeders' Cup is. They run it one day and just got lucky and won. And, you know, it was just nice to see Mr. Lavin enjoy it. And, you know, hey, it is big. You know, it was really nice to win it then.
That, of course, the 1994 Breeders' Cup Distaff and One Dreamer. Tom, outside of your dad and your family, who else has really had a major influence on you and your entire career?
Well, you know, I've always watched people, and this might have hurt me some, as I never really worked for anybody that wasn't part of my family. I wouldn't say that's the way to totally go if somebody's wanting to train horses or a trainer son. I almost think in a way, I almost went to work for Stanley Racer one day, one year, one summer, and that would have been fun because he'd have been a lot easier on me than my dad. Stanley was always a special person to me. But, you know, I always looked up and still do to the older generation trainers. I mean, you know, out in California when I started out, I was always close to Charlie. Charlie watched me a lot. He was funny. I mean, here's a guy who had the best horses in the world, and I'd run some maiden 32 that run fourth, maybe got in a little trouble because she wasn't fast enough. He'd say, oh, that filly run pretty good, but she got hung up a little bit at 3/16 on him. Going, you know, it just amazed me that he'd even pay attention. Out here, Jerry Fanning, really a good guy. I mean, Jack Van Burg would help you out if you needed some help as young. You know, Henry Marino, Warren Studi, those, you know, and three people that were maybe a half a generation were ahead of me was John Veach, David Whiteley, and Leroy Jolly. And those guys had incredible success. And I think maybe in a way I watched them a lot. And I also watch them founder a little bit in the business because maybe they didn't change with a little bit how the business was going. And it made me think that if I did everything exactly like my father, I'd be the same way. And you know, that was a big influence on me watching them. That was my perception, whether it was correct or not, that those three didn't change with the business, even though they were great horsemen, great horse trainers. You know, like I go to Gulfstream. Man, I look for Alan Jerkins. I mean, I want to hear everything he's got to say and stuff like that. I mean, I don't care if it's about life, horses, or what. I want to hear what Alan's, you know, going to talk to me about. And I mean, I look for him and stand next to him and want to listen to him.
Yeah, those guys, I think you and I were lucky in a way that we got to be around guys like Charlie Whittingham and Laz Barrera and those guys you know, really gave a lot to the game and were really, you know, top horsemen. You know, nowadays it seems like that crew is kind of gone by the wayside. And of course, everything's more corporate now, you know, the top.
Yeah, and more changes. And, you know, we talk about corporate, our biggest problem in the business, where's Kenny Noe at? Where's our Kenny Noe? Where's our Lou, Jimmy Kilrow, Tommy Trotter, Howard Battles? You know, Bobby Humphreys was a young guy that we're not going to replace. I mean, where are those guys in our business? I mean, those are, you know, we can, the horse trainers, we might can replace some of the executives that really knew how to run a track and were horse people. Sorry, they're not there right now.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Yeah, I mean, God, do I miss Jimmy Kilrow and Kenny Noe? I mean, Hey, they were tough. They were tough. I mean, you know, if you did wrong, and God, nowadays it's like if you do wrong, they put you front and center. Back then, if you had some bad tests, you didn't get ruled off. They just told you to leave.
Yeah.
You know,
just pack your stuff.
They just said, we don't want you here no more. and now they pretty much put them on make a bobblehead doll, have them sign autographs, put them on talk shows and everything.
Trainer Tom Proctor joining us here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, a man who is closing in on 1,000 career victories. Tom, did you ever imagine that milestone, I know you want it to be within reach, but now that it's getting closer, did you ever imagine that would be a milestone that would be achievable?
Well, you know, each race is an individual deal. This isn't about me as far as the horses go, and it's nice and all that. I mean, there's a lot of guys who win a lot more races and a lot of guys win a lot less. That's kind of how I look at it. But, you know, it's kind of neat. Each race is an individual race. I mean, I get pumped to win a maiden eight, and I get pumped to win a big stake. just enjoy running horses. And, you know, if they mess this business up, I'm going to be running horses on the back of a pickup truck somewhere against you or somebody else. You know, that's how I'm going to That's, I'm going to fly one way or another. And I don't see them messing this business up, because they've been trying for a long time, and I don't think it'll happen.
Well, it's a thing. I think they'll always be racing. I mean, it's you know, it's a shame that it's not looked at more as a sport, and the emphasis is always on gambling and casinos and all of that stuff. But the actual beauty of the game and watching horses race, I think it's irreplaceable.
Yeah, and you know, just the horses. It's all about them, and it, like you said, there's nothing prettier than watching a horse run and give him everything you got, whether you're winning, you know. And I make it a point, like, I've had a lot of nice fillies and everything. Boy, I really, you know, tell myself when I know it's getting close in their career, enjoy every bit about them, enjoy every workout, enjoy when they're racing, enjoy watching them come back to the to unsaddle, and you know, giving them a pat on the head. I mean, God, if you don't love horses and you're training, then you're in the wrong business.
Tom, talk about your team that's involved with your entire organization, because every time we talk to a trainer on Trainer Talk, they tend to say that they couldn't do it without the help of their team. Talk about some of the people involved with your operation.
You know, got very good. I don't know if I call it a team, though. it's kind of something that's come out with Lucas and everything, you know, a long time ago. But we have a stable, and I am lucky. I've got four really good assistants. I have three that, you know, Amy DeLossi in California, and she was a great hire this year. We've been lucky out here and doing well and be able to be competitive. Nikki Carrillo's worked for me since, 89. And a Spanish kid, he's tongue-tied, hard to talk to on the phone, but he's probably better than 95% of the trainers out there. Just a really good horseman and a good person. Loves his horses, which I think you have to do to be successful. And in the Midwest and in Florida, I have a gal that I hired that worked for Frankie Brothers for years. Meaner than hell, but loves her horses. Tough to work for. Runs a great barn, and Leanne Sloan, and you know, whether you like her or not, God darn, she runs a good barn, and really a good girl, and God, she, you know, spends tremendous amount of time in the barn, all three of them do. And just lately, I'm a little worried, because you got three operations. You worry if somebody might get hurt or their family gets sick. I kind of hired a barn manager, a roving assistant, and a girl called Lindsay Schultz. She had worked for me previously in between her time from graduating University of Louisville, which I have hired some of the kids, you know, that were going to school there through the years, being that I'm based, you know, have a outfit based at Churchill. But Lindsay Schultz was a graduate of that program, was a very overachiever. She did the Head Start or Flying Start at Darley. And like most, a lot of college kids right now, she didn't have a job when she came out of there, and came out of school, and actually it just worked out good that I got to hire. So she's kind of helping me do the business side. And
looks like we lost him.
I guess there's nobody else on his team. That's it. I guess we were going to have to let him go in 1 minute anyways, but I guess his cell phone ended up cutting out on us there. But what great stuff from Tom Proctor, and an amazing visit with him, an amazing visit with Hall of Famer Bill Mott in the first half of the show. A podcast of this program will be available for you on our website, horseracingradio.net, and on iTunes tomorrow. So make sure you look for that at horseracingradio.net.
Yeah, that's too bad we lost him there at the end.
Thank you, Tom. we appreciate it.
I'll give him a call after the show.
I bet you his battery died on his phone.
Yeah, it might have.
All right, we are back tomorrow afternoon, 3 to 7 Eastern Time, our coverage from Aqueduct, Gulfstream, and Hollywood Park. And then from 6 to 7, our final Furlong show, a listener call-in show. Tomorrow night, every Thursday, you get a chance to call in. Let us know your thoughts on the world of thoroughbred racing and anything else that might be on your mind. Do it with us tomorrow night, 6 o'clock. We're here Friday as well, 3 to 7 Eastern time. Our weekend stakes preview from 6 to 7. And then our Equine Forum show Saturday morning from 8 to 10. You can visit horseracingradio.net for a complete schedule and hrnlive.com.
Sounds good. Can't wait for tomorrow. It's going to be fun.
Our thanks to Bill Mott and to Tom Proctor for joining us here on Trainer Talk. Thanks for listening, everybody. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, and Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you tomorrow on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.